But the tag
you stopped with the boards from the Civic Light Opera, so can we continue?
Yeah. Then I was on the board of the Health Research Foundation, self-help group network, on the board of the Mendelssohn Choir, on the board of course, the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters. I devoted a lot of time to that. I still do some work as on the advisory board of the Salvation Army. And with the station, I was in so many activities that were current at that particular time. Frankly, I can't remember the...
Okay, that's all.
Yeah.
Now, would you like to talk a little bit about Franklin P. Snyder?
Yeah, C.
Franklin C.
Yeah, Franklin C. Snyder was a pioneer in broadcasting. He's a native Pittsburgher, grew up in, I think, the Swissvale Regent Square area. He went to, Swissvale High School or Edgewood High School, I'm not sure. But anyhow, he went to Carnegie Tech, and he was an architecture student. And upon graduation, he married a woman who was in the drama department, who's still a famous actress. Her name was Polly Rowles, R-O-W-L-E-S. And for a while, she used to use the name Polly Rowles Snyder. She was under contract to Hollywood in around the 1940s, early 40s. And Frank, he was a playboy on the West Coast while she worked. He had a good time. And then they came back to Pittsburgh, and she never really made too many movies since, but she's done a tremendous amount of Broadway, including Andy Mame. She was in that show for years. And the last thing she did was nothing to be proud of, but she made a lot of money. She was Packer number 12 in the Hanes underwear commercials. Do you remember that woman? But anyway, then Frank and she were divorced, and he remarried. He worked in Philadelphia. He worked for Jones and Lachlan here, and he worked for a couple other things. And during the war years, he went to work for a friend of his, David Langworthy, in Philadelphia as a salesman for his father's electrical firm, I believe. In one of his trips to Cleveland, one of the men said, "You know, I just gotten a license to open a television station." And he said, "Would you like to run it for me?" This is absolute true. Frank said, "Well, yeah, I've always been interested in the theater a little bit." But he said, "Well, why don't you do it?" So he went to Cleveland in 48 and put that station on the air. And he got the Cleveland Indian Games. And his wife became the publicity director, and in no time, the station just took off, which was not impossible in those early days. He became a very successful broadcaster until the mid-50s or so. The station was bought by Westinghouse in Cleveland. And then he was working in an advertising agency, and when I told you earlier that they wanted to get the license here, there was a gentleman in local broadcasting named Leonard Kapner. I don't know if his name showed up anywhere, but he was an old-time Pittsburgher, K-A-P-N-E-R. And Leonard ran that WCAE radio for years, and he hired Frank Snyder to be his vice president and general manager here. Frank came down from Cleveland, put the station on the air, and he was one of the, as far as I was concerned, he was an innovator. And he was a local market man, which I don't think television people do today. It's so standardized, but he used to say, "Well, this is Pittsburgh and they'll like this." Or, "I believe we should do this," and then when somebody said, "But they're not doing that anywhere else," and he'd say, "I don't care if they're not doing it." Today, it's totally different. Today, television are like the green signs on the interstates. Any place you're in America, you're gonna see Oprah Winfrey at 4 o'clock and Phil Donahue at 5, and you're gonna see MASH at 7:30. But he did some great things in the early years, built a staff of really Pittsburghers. That was his theory. It was almost totally Pittsburgh natives that ran the station. And I became his sort of assistant in many ways. And we traveled together. We went to all the broadcasting conventions together. I also went to all the Pennsylvania broadcasters also had spring conventions in the islands. Don't ask me why. But they did, and I would go to MC their dinners, and I think I had about 17 trips to the islands over those years, and Frank was on many of those trips. We became very good friends. And then eventually he took over all the Hearst broadcasting stations, which included one television and two radio stations in Milwaukee, and one television and AM and FM radio in Baltimore, this one in Pittsburgh, but it's an AM and FM and the TV. Then later bought Dayton, Kansas City, and most recently Boston. And by the time he retired, they had quite a little combine. And then he retired. He stayed here in Pittsburgh. He came to the station at his will. You know, they never shut him out. And he had lived in Florida part-time. And unfortunately, about a year ago, he had a stroke, and he passed away last December. And typical of him, I ended up handling his funeral. You know, I would handle most everything for him. But he was quite a man, and he was great for broadcasting.
You mentioned a Yiddish letter in the last tape. Do you have it?
No, but I can get it. But okay. I'll tell you what, I do have some other things that I also can tell you about.
Okay. The repertoire theater in at CMU, do you have any information about that?
You mean in the repertory theater that they had there?
Yes.
They had it, but that was after my time.
Okay.
They did it in the summers, but I was not part of it.
Did you ever get the name of I Remember Mama? Was it Woods?
It was in Broadway. It was Irene Wood. And the one I played was with Mady Christians.
Okay, so Irene Woods was on Broadway.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay.
The Mady Christians was the one that I did it with up at Summerstock.
Did you run into Andy Warhol at any time at CMU? Do you have any Andy Warhol? Mm-hmm.
We were in school at the same time, and I frankly have very poor recall of him at all. I remember Philip Perlstein, who was in that same period as a famous artist, but I don't remember Andy Warhol. However, it's strange that you asked this. Two nights ago, this friend of mine is in from California, the actor who went to school with me, and we're going out to dinner, and our middle son is driving, and he said to my friend, calls him Uncle Al, he's not really his uncle, he said, Uncle Al, I'm going to show you something, and my parents haven't seen it. Took me down Route 88 and on Connor Road that goes to where the Kaufmans used to be in the South Hills. Took me up a side road, it's a cemetery, and there's Andy Warhol's grave. And kids come by several times a week and throw tomato soup cans at it.
Campbell's
soup cans. And
Route 88 in the South Hills?
Yeah, and Connor Road, and I saw it just... I mean, it's a little black stone, and Steve said somebody showed it to him, and he said, and you come up, and they go, and they're placing Campbell's tomato soup cans on the grave.
Do you know what the grave says? Do you have any idea, any way of describing it?
It's, as I say, it does give his name, and then it says Warhol, though.
Right.
The full name, and the dates, and I don't, from the distance, I couldn't see, but he showed it to us, and I had never even known it was there, but it's really in Castle Shannon.
So it's a modest grave, is that what you're saying?
Oh, totally, and a very modest cemetery. It looks like somebody made it up.
Okay.
You know.
Philip Perlstein, you mentioned as well.
Yeah, well, he was
the
school
artist
over there.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Anything?
Nice stuff.
No, but my wife knew him better, because I think he had also, I think, if I remember correctly, I think he came out of Alderdice, too.
And you mentioned Jack Klugman.
Yeah.
Lucy knowing him? Or
yeah, and he was in my class. I mean, he was in her class. But,
okay.
Yeah, we were in school together. I've seen Jack through the years. And, you know, we're friends. I mean, not close friends, but we're friends. And
he's been an actor how many years?
Jack's been an actor since 1948.
And didn't he have a television series?
Yeah.
He was a physician.
The Odd Couple with Tony Randall.
Right.
And... then he had a second one called Quincy.
Right.
And I remember when he started doing Quincy, I was with him, and he said to me that starting this new show, he said if he gets 3 years out of it, he can retire because he'll be a millionaire. Well, the show ran 7 years, so that's when he started with his horses. And the sad part is, though, Jack's had, he said, cancer of the throat twice now. And I don't even know at this moment if he talks, because I see he's a new commercial on with Randall eating some kind of potato chips, and he doesn't really say anything. He doesn't. And I know he had lost one vocal cord, and he was hanging on to the other one. This was about 2 years ago, and he may still have some voice left. I don't know, but not much. Really, real shame, yeah.
You mentioned Hill Street Blues.
Yeah, that whole crowd, that's out of Carnegie Mellon, but that's really after my day with, you know, Steve Bochco, Barbara Boson, Whites, and Charlie Haid. They're almost the next generation. My days, Seda Thompson, who did Family on television, she's doing a commercial now. Nun Marchand, who was the Mrs. Pinchot in the Lou Grant series, she was in our class. Carl Betts, who died quite young, who did Judge for the Defense, did the Donna Reed show. He was of our era. And my friend that was in town just now is Al Checco, is an actor. He's been an actor since 1947. He graduated with my wife and came back to Pittsburgh since he has no family, came back to Pittsburgh to leave his estate to Carnegie Mellon. That's what he was doing here this week. Yeah.
Dan Roper, do you remember him at all?
No.
All right. What I really wanted to ask you about is, do you have any recollection, personal recollections of the McCarthy era at CMU?
Oh, yeah. Not at CMU. I know it better from New York, because when I was in New York, it was starting. And
what year?
49. And then, of course, I knew some people's names when I came back here in the early 50s when it really blossomed. But my friend that I just told you about, Al Checco, he was in a Broadway show called Lindeneer that got its start at the Playhouse. Charlie Gaynor wrote it, and one of the guys in the show was the comic, supposedly. He was called in, and he, like, told on everybody, which in many cases held no water, but he wrecked a lot of careers. I can remember being in New York.
Remember the comic's name?
Hall. Can't think of his first name. I think it's Rich Hall. I also remember that when I was in New York, a lot of my friends who were in the theater would go after when they were in Broadway shows, they would go afterwards to a theater where there'd be meetings. And they were very liberal, leftist type meetings. There was no question about it. Sam Wanamaker used to hold a lot of them. And then when he got hit so hard, he spent the next 20 years of his life in London as an actor. I see he's back here now. I worked with a guy who used to be on Hee Haw, John Quayle, I can't remember. He was a singer, sat around a stove and did hot stove kind of little philosophies. He was destroyed by it, and he was out of the country for years. I knew of a sort of a distant relative of mine who married one of the screenwriters that got blackballed, the famous 10 of them, I guess it was. Dalton Trumbo was the top one. This guy's name was Bright, and they went to Mexico City. Funny part is almost all those writers continued to write. They did movies under different names.
Explain that, because Woody Allen, in fact, made a movie about that.
What they did is they would just, some in Mexico City, some in Canada, some in London, and they would write movies and they'd send them to their agents. Their agents would put somebody else's name on it, and they'd submit them to studios, and studios would say, John Harrison, a pretty good screenplay. What else has he done? They make some stuff up, and they didn't care. And they were still writing, so most of them didn't miss a beat. But most of the actors and actresses took a bum rap on it. And many of them were blackballed in advertising agencies from ever doing commercials. And mostly, the advertising agencies controlled the radio and television shows in those days. Like when I lived in New York, the Fred Allen Show, the Jack Benny Show, would be Fred Allen Show brought to you by the Ford Motor Company. Ford and J. Walters Thompson owned the show, not the network. It was a different kind of setup in those days. And so, if your name got on a bad list, they never put you on the show. And a lot of people were falsely accused. Some were accused correctly, but the point was that what they were doing, actors are, excuse the expression, but they are like children. And they'd go almost anywhere and they'd join almost any cause, whether they understood it or not. Most of these cases, they weren't even being duped. It was exciting to them. I had a friend of mine who went to Camp Wingfield. He wanted to work in the summer. It was a job. He got up there and there's, you know, Canada Lee, who was a black actor who did Native Son. He's there for the summer. Now these, they were all very liberal people. And pretty soon here, now I'm not to say that there weren't some communist influences here, and they probably took advantage of some of them if they could. But most cases, I don't think any of them, most of them, at least the ones I knew, had no idea of overthrowing the government. I mean, they had trouble making the Wednesday matinee, most of these people. They, you know, actors are, bless their soul, as someone once said, they should wake them in the morning, dress them, feed them, let them play in the sandbox till it's time to go to work, then pick them up, give them a bath, and put them to bed, and there'd be no trouble. Because, you know, they're gypsies. They really are. And these people, and it was a wonderful thing to get a hold of for Joe McCarthy. It was a hell of a show thing. And if you're blasting somebody with a Hollywood name or a big stage name, certainly meant a lot more than some little guy from the south side of Pittsburgh who works in a steel mill, you know. So, but it was a very frightening era. And the sad part is that many of those people didn't recover for 20 years, if ever. And during that time, they had no career unless they went out of the country. It was a strange period. And of course, his miserable legal counsel was no winner either.
No. Do you have your own memory? I know you were very young. I recollect probably 17 years old, Pearl Harbor. Do you have a memory of...
Absolutely.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a good memory of it. As a matter of fact, I was this past weekend when Mayor Maslow's husband died. I had a call at home early in the morning, and somebody told me about it, and they said, maybe you better tell your newsroom. So I called, and I got hung up. They had some weekend, either minimum salaried person or intern on the desk, and I said, no wonder the Japanese attacked on Sunday morning. They knew nobody would be working with any intelligence. I remember it well. I was a freshman in Carnegie Tech, and my sister had always been a pretty good symphony goer, and we always had tickets, I guess, from student ticket days. I don't know how they did those things in those days. But we would go to the symphony, and my father would like to go. He never said much and never asked to go, but if you said, we have an extra ticket, do you want to go to the symphony? He'd say, mm-hmm, and he'd go to the symphony, and he always seemed to enjoy the symphony. So this was a Sunday, December 7th of 41, and I was called into Carnegie Tech to put together a freshman show for the upperclassmen, which was a traditional thing they did. And it was a very bad show. It had a terrible name called Plebe It or Not, which was terrible. And I remember my father and sister wanting to go to the Syria Mosque for the 3 o'clock concert. So I made a deal with them. I drove them in our family car to the Syria Mosque in Oakland, dropped them off, and said I wasn't sure what time would be through rehearsal. So they said they would take a streetcar home and that I could keep the car and then come home for dinner. And so I rehearsed all afternoon with other freshman students in the drama department. And then when I got home, they were there already and they were listening to the radio, and they told me what had happened. The next morning I went to school. We all gathered in the foyer of the Fine Arts Building, and they piped in Franklin Roosevelt's speech, and we all stood there, and especially the young men, we were all looked at each other because we knew we were in trouble and didn't know when we'd go, but we figured that we sure will be going, and that's what happened. Then we immediately all got back into our normal work at school and saw all this was going on around us. Some of the guys took off early. There were some in the reserve. Some were old enough. Some volunteered to go. I was not quite old enough to go yet. I was a year under. And so I stuck it out, finished that year. The next year I had to register for the draft, and I did. And I didn't quite make it through my sophomore year, but they gave me credit. I was within a couple of weeks of doing it. And a lot of them signed up for a program called, it was like an enlisted training program. And this was supposed to keep them safe for a while. And I gambled and didn't do it. I don't know why. So they all left before me, my friends, and they went off to strange things. Like one of them went to water purification school, and we used to laugh because he washed out of that. And then I stuck it out until April of the following year.
What year? April of
43.
And that's when you went in.
And that's when I went in, and I was like about 18 and a half, and I luckily got into the Air Corps, don't ask me why, and became a weatherman. It was a lot easier. But I remember it well, yeah.
All right, David, I'd like you to talk about 50 grand. You mentioned it, you talked about it being produced at the Playhouse.
It was a show that I wrote with, when I first came back to Pittsburgh, in the fall of 49 to take a job at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. I ran into a friend of mine with whom I had written a college show. His name was Ken Welch. And Kenny was a good musician, a good artist. He was in Warhol's class too, and then he switched to drama school. And he was a good musician, he was everything. And he later went on to work for Carol Burnett. And I think with their new show coming back next year, I think he's gonna be back on it. But he and I had an idea. We wanted to do a musical. It was traditionally done every spring at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, a musical review. One of them went on to Broadway called Lendonier. And this was a day before television really had taken over, and you didn't see those skits and songs and dances, and the spring review was sort of something people loved to do. We had an idea for a show, and we started to work on it. And the idea, it was a review, but it had a thread. And the thread was that a baby was born at the stroke of 1900. And we followed her through the first half of the century.
That part, I don't mean to interrupt you. That you've told
Did
on
I
the first,
yes, yeah.
that we know. I just wanted to know, because I got the feeling, and if you know, not don't want to address this, is okay. Mm-hmm. That would you have been more established?
If it had gone, yes.
That was sort of what I, because that
well,
was
you know, you don't know, but I would imagine that if I wanted to be a writer, which I thought I wanted to be, if the show had ever gotten on Broadway, once I had that Broadway credit, I'm sure I, and the money, because the percentage for having a show on Broadway is high. I mean, you can make a lot of money. If I had had the show, if it had ever opened, and even if it wasn't a smash, but if it had been a fair success, it would have been easy for me to write more and to have producers give me an ear and so forth. But yes, I think it could have changed.
And what happened to it?
Well, it was sort of a timely show in a way. It was meant to play around that time. It reverted to us after 8 months, and I think Kenny may have used something elsewhere. I've just never done anything with it. Most of the stuff belonged in the show. It wouldn't work outside of the structure. And we had the songs published. I think there are three or four songs published by BMI from that show.
BMI meaning?
Broadcast Music Institute, I think it's called. It's like ASCAP. It's a writing thing for it's protection for royalties for stuff. But, you know, we never made much money on it. And yes, I think it could have changed your life, but you know, that's true of a lot of things. You know, I could have left the station in 1966 and go to California, which I planned to do. But you know, you never know.
I also wanted to know, why were the Boy Scouts, why did the Swissville, Lawrenceville Boy Scouts meet at Ney Israel rather than in Lawrenceville?
Well, they didn't. I did. It was, the troop was the B'nai Israel troop, and I would come from Lawrenceville because I wanted to belong to that troop. That's all I wanted.
Did you run into any anti-Semitism in Lawrenceville?
Yes, very much.
Very much meaning what?
Lots.
Such as?
Name calling, and very obviously, being the only Jewish kid in the class, you got it.
And the teachers as well?
No, I don't remember any teacher discrimination, but kids, and the kids would probably repeat the parents, you know, and they would, you know, yell at you and call you Jew or the name, can't remember, Sheeny, you know that name? That seemed to be a phrase, I don't know, of that era, I don't even know what it means. And once in a while, I avoided fights very well. I was very good at avoiding them. But a couple times I had some problems and dumb things that pick on you. And especially if you were, I won't say I was bright, but I was probably brighter than most of the kids because of my family, the, you know, the interest. Yeah, I went through it. And I felt very, very aware of it. But we were all, my sister and I were always told by our parents, you know, you're going to get this, and when you do, just walk away from it. And
were there other prejudices that you're aware of looking back in retrospect? Because it was a sort of a multi-ethnic community.
Well, it was predominantly Catholic, and predominantly Middle European and Irish. They picked on each other. I don't think there's ever been a Serb or a Croatian or a Serbian that got along, you know, so they would pick on each other. I became very friendly with the only black kid in my class, Philip Berry. He and I became buddies, and he was very good to me. And it was funny how I guess we gravitated toward one another, maybe for safety's sake. But there definitely was anti-Semitism there. It was not so much picked upon, but that we were different. My family was different, and we were different. I think they used to think of us as rich, and we were anything but rich. But in the Depression years, we at least ate. And my mother, I remember, taking apple butter to school, so they had school lunches, that we supplied that. And believe me, I know things weren't real good, because my father went out of the jewelry business into the dress business, in the same cabinets, and then after so many years out of the dress business, back to the jewelry business, you know, just to sustain. So,
but your mother did volunteer, so to speak, and that was charity, actually.
Yeah, and I gather we had a few bucks, but not much, you know. We did have a car, which I guess was unique, too. Of course, we had it for like 10 years, you know. And the name of the synagogue there, which we talked about before, my sister said, was called the Butler Street Congregation, or Butler Street Synagogue. There was no other name for it.
You mentioned a civic club where you received your CMU scholarship.
There was a group of women, I believe, that had an organization called the Civic Club of Pittsburgh. And their idea was they did charitable work and they had scholarships. And they arranged a test every year for students who had a certain either level, academic or IQ type thing. And then if you scored well enough, they would help you. And obviously, I don't know if they ever checked on your financial status in those days or not, but nobody had any money. My sister only went to college because she got a full scholarship. She'd never have gone.
But that was, I guess, the whole idea of the scholarship program in those days. Okay, play Believe It or Not. There was, you mentioned a play, Believe It or Not.
Hmm.
Well, if you don't remember
that. No, I remember.
All right, can you tell me a little bit about Donald Wilkins?
Donald Wilkins, he was in my high school class. He's now an organist at one of the churches, head of the Pittsburgh Oratorio. He's a very good musician. I think he studied the Sorbonne. I think he also studied organ in Paris. He's still very active as a teacher. And
where, at Duquesne? Or?
No, I think he's done some work at Pitt. But mostly he's tied up, well, I don't even know which church it is. One of the ones along Fifth Avenue. And he and I became friends in high school, and if you can believe it, the two of us sang and danced to Darktown Strutters Ball. I don't know why we did that, but we were a hit, I guess. Thank God he was there, because I'm sure I was off key. His father was a business manager for all the musicians in this town, but I haven't seen Don in many years, but I run into him once in a while.
Oh, also, you mentioned, I think maybe it was in connection with Jack Klugman, the name of a toothpaste. Your wife was involved with a toothpaste commercial, or was he?
No, it was Ernie Motil, and I think I was talking about, maybe that's the guy that did commercials for Crest.
Right, okay, Crest Toothpaste.
Yeah, Crest
okay.
Toothpaste. Yeah.
And Dorothy Kilgallen, do you have anything to talk about?
Well, when I worked in New York, I would call on people like Dorothy Kilgallen, Leonard Lyons, Ed Sullivan. I remember just going to her apartment. She wasn't a very nice person, I remember. Very curt. Sullivan was, he had like a henchman that you really dealt through. Leonard Lyons was nice, you remember him at all.
He's the writer, right?
Yeah, he had a column. These writers were very big. They were like the Donahue's, Oprah Winfrey's
sure.
of today, you know. And
And Walter Winchell, any?
Well, I used to do stuff for his column too, and I did spend one evening with him at the Stork Club. Don't know how it happened, but I happened to be there with these men that I worked with, and they called us over, and we spent the evening at his table where he wore his hat the whole evening.
That was his hangout, wasn't it?
Yeah. Wore his hat and had his telephone at the table, and everybody came by and paid him homage. And he could make or break you as an entertainer. It was a strange world. So it was true of other people like Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper in those days. If you were on the bad side of them, you were gone. Winchell was a very tough man, but he was also worked for the Hearst Corporation.
Do you think he was fair?
No, I don't think any of those people are fair. They get power, man, and they play favorites. You know.